Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. If you ever ate at the Romanelli Grill or bought audio equipment at the old Brandsmart, if you ever rode the Country Club streetcar line to or from 75th and Warnell or went to a performance at Waldo Astoria, if you've run the trolley run or hoisted a drink at Kennedy's or the Well, you've spent time in a part of Kansas City called Waldo. Unlike, say, Westport, Waldo was never a town of its own, only a neighborhood of small businesses and later homes that, like so many neighborhoods in our town, developed its own identity. Our first guest today is LaDeen Morton, who has written a book about this neighborhood, The Waldo Story, published by the History Press. LaDeen, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Thank you, Monroe.
Probably most of us who have a passing acquaintance with this part of Kansas City, Missouri, and with Kansas City's many neighborhoods, know that Waldo is a district kind of centering on Warnell Road at 75th Street. But for starters, what are the boundaries that you've set for this area?
For my purposes, I set the boundaries at Gregory to 85th Street, State Line to approximately Troost. But I really focused on the Warnell Road corridor and the Gregory corridor because I was looking principally at the economic development in Waldo.
Which would be small merchants.
Exactly. A little industrial in its past and a few other sordid things.
Now, let's get this out of the way at the beginning of the program. This is not the Waldo of Where's Waldo?
No, this is not.
That spectacle character from the cartoon strip that's always lost in the crowd. How then did this neighborhood get its name?
Well, it got its name from Dr. David Waldo, who was the first person to purchase property in that part of Jackson County in 1841. That was shortly after the county was, or that part of the county was taken in. And being someone who was working on the Santa Fe Trail, interested in Santa Fe trade, he saw it as a logical place to establish a farm, principally for the purposes of boarding his prize mules that he used on the trail. So that was his main interest.
David Waldo was quite a guy.
He was quite a guy. He was quite a character. He came to us from Kentucky and landed first in Gasconade, Missouri, spent some time there making quite a little bit of money, an unspecified amount, but a little bit of money in the lumber trade, had a bevy of brothers who seemed to follow him onward to each new adventure, was enticed to move to Kansas City by Samuel Owen, who was a major figure over in the Independence area, where, of course, the real crux of the Santa Fe Trail business originated, and came here and saw nothing but opportunity. And so he bought that property, although David Waldo himself spent most of his life over in this part of the area in Independence and didn't really live so much on the farm in the Waldo area.
But he took stuff down the Santa Fe Trail. He traded. He went to Mexico.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he gained quite a reputation down there. He is supposedly the first doctor to have practiced in Taos, New Mexico, what is now New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Was good friends with William Bent, who was the first governor of New Mexico and a famed trader. So he lived quite a colorful life during the Santa Fe Trail years, and then also into the war with Mexico. He fought with Doniphan and the Army of the West during that period, and then came back to lead a more sedate life, got married, had a family at sort of an advanced age, and sort of settled into domesticity.
And he did not start anything called Waldo.
He did not have an inkling that what he started would end up what it was.
How did it then?
Well, you know, every little bit of economic activity, any place, sort of brings a synergy. You had David Waldo, who started his farm there. You had Alexander Majors, who established his place over on what is now State Line.
The freighter.
Mm-hmm. The famed freighter, Pony Express, founder. And I've been told that Majors established his place there so that he could graze his cattle on the Kansas side, which was, of course, not Kansas at the time, and avoid taxes. So there was a lot of speculation in the early days. You know, it's land speculation. It's what drives economic development. And that's how it started. And every phase of its life after that, through the railroad years, through the housing boom of the 20s, it brought an opportunity for people to come to Waldo and sort of speculate on the latest boom. And the culmination is a lot of different influences in Waldo that sort of make it that eclectic a neighborhood that it is today.
Dr. David Waldo's son was one of those speculators, and he named his subdivision, he didn't name it Willow Oaks or Fox Run.
No. He named it after himself, or perhaps in fairness, maybe it was a tribute to his father. Mm-hmm. But yes, he was one of the first people to start giving the name Waldo to the area. Although, you know, in the early days, it was very common for roads to pick up the names of the principal property owners. One time, Gregory was known as Waldo Lane because it would have been a major road that led in from the eastern part of the county to the area around Waldo, much as Warnell Road became Warnell Road because it was Warnell Lane, because it was the lane that led to the Warnell Homestead. Mm-hmm. So, yes, David Waldo was one of the first to put that name on it, and one of the first things he put his name on was a racetrack that was approximately at the area of 75th and Holmes, a little off to the northwest there, a horse racetrack.
And are we in the 1890s?
Yeah, you're in the 1890s there. And as you know from your study of the streetcars, it was very common for the streetcar lines to terminate in picnic areas. And they were trying to promote people to go out into the country and have a lovely day. Well, this was one of those ideas. His did not really stick the way some of the others did. And that racetrack only lasted for a couple of years.
But the streetcar line lasted until the into the 60s for freighting purposes. That was a rail line that stretched from Westport down to meet the Missouri Pacific at
exactly. History of the railroad, of course, is big in Kansas City's history, very formative. And I was excited and surprised a little to find out exactly how much it had influenced Waldo as well. We know about the story of the Hannibal Bridge and the Hannibal and St. Joseph Railroad that came from the north. But all that time, the Missouri Pacific was moving on the south side of the river westward across the state. And with no particular fanfare, someone said, gee, you know, we've got all these interurban lines and all these connections. Let's connect that Missouri Pacific line back up to Westport. And that led right through Waldo. So that was a big piece of what came to form Kansas City, because it began to pick up some industrial activity. And farmers could bring their goods to market there. And so that brought growth from the south as well as what was coming down from Westport in the north.
Lumber yards, for instance.
Lots of lumber yards, lots of blacksmithing and early trades. Keep in mind, Waldo was sort of coming into its own in the 20s, as a lot of neighborhoods in Kansas City were. Mm-hmm. There was a huge national housing boom during that period. Certainly Kansas City saw it, evidenced by the work of J.C. Nichols and others. And what I found was that was the time in which many businesses moved into Waldo to take advantage of the proximity to that rail and to support the housing boom. So anything that had to do with building housing, lumber yards, masons, plumbers, electricians later on, et cetera, were all kind of clustered around that rail line.
And because of the houses, groceries, restaurants.
Exactly. When the houses are built, then you follow with the groceries, the hardware stores, the doctors, the dentists, and all the things people need on a day-to-day basis.
And you've got today's Waldo. Unlike Westport, Waldo was never its own incorporated area.
Never its own incorporated area, but in the last few years, it has seen a certain a level of political officialness in that it has become a community improvement district. Mm-hmm. And as such, it is a political subdivision, just not with the same stature as a city, but much like a city. So now, here, you know, 170 years after it was born, it's finally sort of picked up some of that cachet, if you will.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, and today we're talking with LaDine Morton about Waldo, the neighborhood of Kansas City, Missouri that centers on 75th and Warnell. Later in this hour, we'll hear about one of the city's oldest churches and its effort to recover from a disastrous fire. So the 1920s, LaDine, housing and everything, there's some J.C. Nichols, but there are other developers working down there too.
There are. Some of them I learned about when I did a earlier book on the Brookside area, people like Fletcher Coward. But the other developer most associated with the Waldo area is Napoleon Dibel, who is also an equally interesting man. I think the Nichols story is pretty well known, but Dibel was a hardworking, astute businessman who knew nothing about housing when he came to Kansas City, fell into it as a function of a bad business deal that he was sort of left with, and decided, well, if you know, I'm in the construction business, I better learn the construction business. He spent a lot of time really learning all the aspects of it, and he had a really strong work ethic, a highly religious man, and had a deep belief that even the middle class should be able to own their own home. So he became very inventive in terms of finding ways to construct housing that was still presented quality housing but was a little cheaper, things that today would be sort of what we would consider modular housing, you know, a set number of floor plans that made it easy and cheap for him to build.
And you can still recognize Dival houses because a lot of them are, as you call them, faux English Tudors.
Exactly. And I mean that with no disrespect, but it's a much beloved Kansas City style. And certainly Nichols built some in that style, too, so it's not a hard and fast. But, yes, you see the timber framing and the stucco, the little bits of turret or steep gables. You might be looking at a Dival house.
Although the transition from Nichols houses to Dival's houses is kind of subtle.
Yeah. It is, and I think that was intentional. It was part of the thinking in that time. It was certainly part of Nichols' thinking that you did not have those sort of strict demarcations. You look through the Country Club District, there's a fine job of how they move from to smaller and smaller lot sizes, smaller houses, but still reflect the same quality and architectural style. And I think the other developers of the age picked up on that.
Now, before we leave J.C. Nichols, he was a guy who did not look as fondly upon this rail as some of the merchants and lumberyards did.
Well, he had a love-hate relationship, I think, with it. And I think that's fair to say. You know, Nichols, when he first started up in what is today near UMKC, just south of the plaza, took advantage of the rail that went from Westport down to that point and wanted to extend it down to the Brookside area. Even though he was building his neighborhoods for the streetcars, he understood that the streetcar had a role to play there. But he didn't like the freight that went down that rail, and he tried very hard to keep it from happening. He was unsuccessful in that, but it did sort of diminish over the years. Later on in the 50s and 60s, those easements became points of contention between the city and property owners as to what their future would be. The mixed reaction that the Nichols Company had went from J.C. to his son Miller, who also had other ideas about how people should be transported through that part of town.
The line we're talking about today is the Trolley Track Trail.
It is.
And that was the Country Club streetcar line, except when people were hauling lumber and goods down it.
That's right. And for Nichols, during Nichols' time, that freight really stopped sort of short of 75th Street. I mean, it went up to Gregory a little bit, but certainly not any further north than that. It was down in the south part, in the Waldo part, where the freight still hung on.
Now, what you mentioned in your book, the Waldo story, Ladine, that its most famous, and I would agree, son of the Waldo area is one Calvin Trillin.
Indeed.
The man who put Kansas City eating on the map.
Indeed. And Waldonians take great pride in that, as well they should. For one reason, Trillin continues, or certainly has through his literary career, talked freely about his experiences in Kansas City fondly and often. So he owns it fully, and so it's embraced.
And his family ran a restaurant in Waldo.
Indeed. One that today sits in what is now McLean's Bakery, another longtime Waldo institution there at the intersection of Gregory and Rock Hill Road.
Mm-hmm. And he went to Southwest High School. You have said in your book that Waldo is a distinctive area, as distinctive as Brookside. What, in your mind, and you live there.
I have lived in both
places.
What
in your mind
places.
Made it distinctive? What is the character of it?
Well, what I know now is not what I first saw. And what I first saw is probably what many people saw, which is sort of a strange mix of commercial and residential uses going on. What I know now is that two things really came to make it what it is and give it that distinct look. One is this rail influence that we've been talking about. But the second is the really unique role of the merchants in Waldo. And I say that because I've worked over my professional career in community economic development with a lot of places, and never have I found a legacy like there exists in Waldo of businesses being involved in the development of the community. The first business association out there was the Waldo Westmoreland Association, started in 1905 by David Proctor, who was a prominent attorney. And granted, it was his promotion of his own development interests, but businesses around there very early on saw the relationship between the health of their business and the neighborhoods. And so as I unearthed story after story, I just saw evidence where the individual business owners, many of them whom are property owners as well, and I think that's key, had relationships with the area, got on the bandwagon to promote, got on the bandwagon to fight fight the good fight or whatever. A real long-standing tradition of that kind of involvement has made Waldo sort of the place that it is today, at least in my eyes.
And I believe in your book you even cite the businesses that have been around for decades and decades, and so there's plenty of them still. They've hung in.
They have hung in, and it's quite amazing. The oldest one that I have found that I can document is the Waldo Grain Company, which has been there since the turn of the 19th century, so more than 100 and probably close to 120 years, something like that. The Pitkin Building is the oldest building. It's the one that sits on the northwest corner of 75th and Warnell. But there are lots of little businesses that have been there for a number of years.
What was their secret? What was in the spirit of the place that made that happen?
Well, we can only sort of guess. I wish there was more documentation of those early years. But what for some reason, Waldo attracts the same kind of loyalty many of our neighborhoods attract, with no other reason than it's a terrific place to live. I mean, that's the thing that I hear over and over again. One of my favorite stories in the book, I was so pleased to be able to share the story of Betty Tillotson, who is a longtime Waldo resident, really needs the credit for being the true Waldo historian, because she has devoted her life to picking up tidbits, and she shared all of that with me. But hers is quintessential. They came over from Kansas City, Kansas. They fell in love with the place. They lived there. She built a business there. Her whole world became Waldo. I mean, in the best sense, not in the negative sense. Yeah. And I've just found a lot of people who feel that sort of connection. They feel like they can go in shops and talk to people that they've known for generations.
How did you personally connect with Waldo?
Well, I first lived just off the corner of Gregory and Warnell Road about 1980, and got to enjoy living across the street from Romanelli's, as you mentioned. And so, I thought, well, this is the best thing in the world, having a great restaurant across the way. When I came back from grad school, I moved into Waldo a little further south because some friends invited me into the neighborhood, suggested I could live there. And I ended up staying about 18 years.
So it worked for you.
It did.
Waldo, you can tell as you drive through Waldo that there's a change in the streetscape and other stuff just south of 75th, 77th Street. That was because part of Waldo was in the city of Kansas City for the first half of the 20th century, right, and part wasn't.
Right, yeah. Right. And of course, this line ran across the city, so Waldo wasn't the only one affected. But you're right. The city limits went to about 77th Street, and I think it was 1909. You were good enough to remind me, and I appreciate that. And then it was after the war that they moved further south to about 85th. And so, it was a very different character. The boom had come through the 20s when the bust of the Depression hit. A lot of growth stopped, and just sort of, things, it's like keeping it under a glass bubble for about, 15 years.
We have an email from Bill in Lenexa who wants to know what you know about Kittyland Amusement Park at 84th and Warnell.
Well, Kittyland was one of the stories I was most excited to share because, as you can imagine, folks of our age have a lot of nostalgia. There was a pony ride at that intersection before Kittyland came along. And in the book, I have a few pictures, and I managed to find a list of the rides that were there. One of the things that I learned, though, about Kittyland, not to take the shine off of it, is that Kittyland was just sort of a generic name for amusement parks of that scale. And there were plenty of Kittylands all over the country. That doesn't take away, of course, from the experience of Kansas City. So it was there from the mid-50s to, I think, the early 60s, when it was finally too valuable a property to keep in that kind of service and was condemned and torn down. Plus, you can imagine the liability issues. No lawyer in their right mind would allow that kind of an operation today.
There's pictures throughout your book, but there's a picture of a bunch of children riding a little train, like at the you saw at parks around Kittyland.
Exactly, and there's a great picture. Also, one of my favorites is you see adults and children alike on the little roller coaster. With cars whizzing by and people. And then there's another one of them standing outside the ice cream purveyor, which was run by Country Club Dairy, which was a popular dairy at that time. And in this picture are children, Shriners, and nuns. And I just think that that says so much. You know, Christ the King was just across the street. Waldo has several parishes. Uh-huh. So, you know, I could just imagine the kind of event that, you know, the church, the Shrine Club, and did to bring the kids to Kittyland. I think it says it all.
That's wonderful. Now, there's some landmarks that many of us who've done any hanging around in Kansas City noticed. The Water Tower is one of them.
The Water Tower is a great story. And again, I have to give thanks to all the people who've been out there doing the really hard work. There is a group called the Waldo Tower Historical Society that's working to renovate that. But that was built, again, back when at the very beginning of the housing boom, about 1920, to bring water capacity. It didn't last very long. You know, again, when the bus came and growth continued out south. But it has remained a real landmark for the neighborhood. It's at Holmes and 75th, and it sits in what is now called Tower Park because the tower was there. And it had a bit of tragedy. It has one of the few sad stories I found, which was a young man had fallen into it. It was very often a place, as you can imagine, before people thought to make things safe, but kids would be able to climb up there. And unfortunately, one young man did and was missing for a number of months before some other kids who climbed up there found him and caused quite a stir, of course, in the neighborhood when you have to try and take out a body from a long, tall tower.
It's true of water towers in every town in America and maybe the world. Kids love to climb them.
Absolutely.
And this one came to an untimely end. In fact, there were some children who had gone up there looked down and told the story, and at first they weren't entirely credible.
Well, you could imagine, you know, it's the kind of urban legend that kids tell one another, and it sort of stayed that way. But yes, ultimately, one girl was able to convince her mother to call the police who looked, and unfortunately, sure enough.
Oh, my gosh, that was in the early 60s.
Right.
We have a caller, Claudia from Kansas City. Good morning, Claudia.
Hi. I'd just like to ask if you know why they the city or the Kansas City ATA took out the trolley track. I mean, they wouldn't allow it to be run any longer, and I was wondering if you knew why they did that.
Well, it's a long involved story. I mean, it took probably 30 years, 40 years to resolve the whole issue of the right of way. But the long and short of it is when there was contention about who had access to that right-of-way, ultimately the ATA said, we don't want to relinquish access, but we concur that freight trains should no longer roll along this track. And so the compromise position was to let the city of the ATA hold on to the easement but find a more public use. You know, that's part of their charter, is it had to have something to do with public access and transportation, and certainly a bike path and a running path is part of that system.
Well, what I don't understand is why didn't they want the Now I've forgotten the word. Why didn't they want it to be freight?
Oh, well, because, you know, freight is smelly and messy and dangerous, and you bring, you know, lots of ugly things through the neighborhood. Even when it was the what was called the Dodson Dummy Line back in 1919, they would have to dress up the cars to disguise them from what they were so that they didn't frighten horses and they didn't disrupt the neighborhood. You know, that situation only got worse as the years went on.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. You can join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. There are other towns in the vicinity that you mentioned, too. Towns that bear – we mentioned Dodson earlier. These are Dallas, New Santa Fe. These don't exist anymore, but they're in the orbit of Waldo.
They are, and I thought they were interesting little stories to bring in briefly just to sort of put Waldo's growth in the context of what else was going on. Now, Dodson sort of still exists as the Dodson Industrial Area that it's approximately at 85th and Prospect, and that's been an active industrial area since the railroad came through. Named, I understand, for a local property owner. Dallas is what we now call Watts Mill, was what it was known in that day when the Fitzhughes and the Wattses operated the mill along the Santa Fe Trail. And then there was another town that's further out in the 130 range out there on state line called that no longer exists, but there's some vestiges. There's a cemetery, et cetera, called New Santa Fe, which was, again, another one of the stops. You know, the thing about trails is people always want to be the last one as you're leaving on the trail and the first one as you're coming back, right? That's the best spot. That's true today. I mean, that's where they put gas stations on the interstates. And that's what happened here. You know, the Santa Fe Trail, which was not just one road, but a network of trails. People kept trying to jockey for the position to be in, guessing where the big road was finally going to be.
You can drive down State Line Road and spend a lot of time looking at subdivisions and housing and never see a new Santa Fe.
You'll never see a new Santa Fe.
And Watts Mill was where Dallas was, and that was for decades had an actual flour mill there that's
it
now
did.
Just a nice part of the stream.
Yeah, it's a, you can. In fact, I was just out there Wednesday evening. You can see the foundation. It's really beautiful.
We have a caller. Let's go now to Mark in Kansas City. Good morning, Mark.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up on a little dead-end street just west of Tower Park. And my dad and a neighbor actually went up when they saw the fire department at the tower and watched as they kind of fished the guy out of the tower. And I think, last time I was there, I think there's still a scar on this, a little round scar on the tower where, you know, they cut a hole.
That's exactly right, Mark. In fact, that hole had been a part of the system of the construction and the drainage when it was an operating tower. And when they closed it down, they plastered over it. So as they're trying to figure out how they're going to bring this poor young man up out of the tower from above, and that proved impossible, someone remembered that there had been this opening. And so they took a few hours, chiseled it away, et cetera, and finally found it. But I also have to add that the accounts of that evening fit with what you just said. They talk about how they actually had to do more work, the police department did, to control the crowds who were up there at 3 in the morning watching the police and the firemen do all their work than the effort that it took to exhume the young man. So, you know, I'm glad to find somebody who was part of that crowd or at least knows that.
Public psychology will always be elusive on things like this, but I can understand. An emailer wrote, the previous caller asked about freight being eliminated from that trolley line, but why didn't they keep the public trolley active?
Well, you know, in sitting here today, that's a really great question, and I'm 100% with that question. But in going through the history of it, one must remember that there was a long period in which public transit was what we used to do, and the car was the thing to do. In fact, again, jumping back a little bit more into the Brookside story, although the two on this point absolutely dovetail, the initial thinking was that once upon a time in the late 50s, we were going to put a what was going to be called the Country Club Freeway through what essentially is now Brookside Boulevard. Imagine, if you will, what Bruce Watkins Drive looks like, and imagine that going through that part of town. Because what happened was they elected not to do that because of both public outcry and issues over the right-of-way, and they moved it to the east. You can imagine now, I think people have a better appreciation for how decimating that was for the eastern neighborhoods. That's what they wanted to do because the car was king. And in fairness, people like Miller Nichols, who was in control of the Nichols Company at that time, supported that plan because they were building further south. So the rail fell into serious disuse and really wasn't very viable as a railroad.
And if I may add, the streetcar lines of Kansas City were privately owned, and running streetcars, the streetcar company decided, was getting very uneconomical. They far preferred to go to buses, and so it was not the city. It wasn't some public body. It was a streetcar company itself saying, we're losing money, we'll shut it down.
Absolutely.
Unhappy as that may be. Let's go now to Kristen in Kansas City. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning. I had a question. I have driven by for years this building that's taking shape very slowly over on Gregory. It's just east of Warnell, and it's on the south side of the street.
Uh-huh.
And I have no idea what it is. No one I know knows what it is. It looks like it's almost done, and there's still no sign on it.
Well,
do you know which one I'm talking about?
I do. I know exactly what you're talking about, and I can give you a little bit of that building's history. It started out life as an ice plant. And was one of many of the American or City Ice were the dominant ice companies back around the turn of the 19th, 20th century all over Kansas City. So that was an ice plant. In my day, as Monroe referred to in the intro, it was Brandsmart, which was one of the places to go to get your stereo equipment when we were all getting stereo equipment. In the last few years, it's been being renovated by a gentleman who has a lot of property now in Waldo and is doing that. He's sort of got a signature style, this sort of modern, a lot of steel and decorative pieces to it. And I know only that because of the economic times, his renovation process has been slowed down considerably.
Oh, okay. But do you know what it's going to be?
I do not.
Oh, okay. So it really isn't anything specific yet.
Not to my knowledge. He may have a very specific plan for it, but my experience tells me developers keep those things close to the vest.
Okay. All right. Well, I just been so fascinated by that building. I think it's beautiful what he's done, and I don't know whether it's going to sell cars or be a restaurant. I mean, I just don't know what it's going to be.
It's one of the surprises of Waldo.
Well, I'll keep looking.
Me too.
Finding that out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Kristen. Now, Ladine Morton, you are going to be appearing at the Plaza Branch of the Public Library.
I am. That date is July 19th. You know, they have a fairly regular series, and I'm delighted to do that. We're going to do something similar to what we did for Brookside, which is share a lot of the images that I have found in the course of the research. Not all of them will be brand new, but I think there'll be some that people have not widely seen. And I think it shows parts of Waldo that no one's seen for a good number of years.
So is that in the evening?
Yeah, that's they typically have a reception at 6, and then the presentation starts at 6:30, and that's at the Truman Forum in the Plaza Library.
The Plaza Branch of the Kansas City Public Library on July 19th.
Yes, yeah. But I would be remiss if I didn't say to Waldonians that we're also going to be planning an event at the Waldo Branch that'll be slightly different, and so I hope people can come to both. That one's going to be August 2nd.
Well, Ladine Morton, I thank you for filling us in for filling in my vacant spots in my brain on Waldo, and I'm sure all the Waldonians out there thank you too.
Well, my pleasure.
We'll come back after we take a short break. Afterward, we'll be joined by the Reverend Scott Myers of Westport Presbyterian Church to talk about the fire that took down much of the church in late December and the efforts to rebuild. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. In the last few days of 2011, fire took down a Midtown building representing an institution of long, long standing. It's the Westport Presbyterian Church, whose pastor, the Reverend Scott Myers, has joined us this morning. Good morning, Scott.
Glad to be here, Monroe. Thank you.
And you are certainly welcome to be here. Your congregation dates back to 1835.
That's right.
And that's a long, long way before there was even a Kansas City.
That's right. That's right. There was just a Westport. Yeah, we celebrated our 175th anniversary just a couple years ago.
And it began as the Cumberland Presbyterian, as I understand?
That's right. That's right. It's an Oregon Trail congregation that began when Westport became a big trading area.
And the church that burned is at, I think the address is 201 Westport Road, which is between Broadway and Main Street.
That's right. Across from the public library and the post office.
Yeah, a big fire. What made that happen?
Well, a workman's accident. A workman's accident. It was a very traumatic event for people in the congregation and many people in the community. And I'm glad it's just about 6 months in the rearview mirror right now.
And what, before we go on to what lies in the windshield and the road ahead,
yeah,
let's talk a little bit more about the building. Had been the church has had several buildings.
That's right. The church has had three buildings. Ironically, this building was built in the wake of a fire. A much smaller building burned in the very late 1800s. That was the second building. The first building was up the street, Westport Road to the west, around where Sonic is. Now, the current building was built in 1904 after this fire, and then it was expanded several times with the times in the about 1917, and then again, what became the Willow Woods Child Development Center was expanded in about 1950.
Were you there the night of the fire?
I was.
And talk about that. What must have gone through your mind?
Well, it was just a trauma, and just hundreds of people came out from the church and from the community to hold each other, hug, cry, wonder what's going to happen next, but support each other and think about, okay, where are we going to go from here, even though this is a horrible thing.
Other churches offered their facilities. Second Presbyterian, you were...
They did. We were so grateful to Second Presbyterian. Lots of others offered. That just happened to be the most convenient for us at the time. And we were there for about a month for worship services and Sunday school, and they were just so hospitable to us. It was just wonderful. And I can tell you, it felt so good, and I know that I have, and many people in the congregation, you know, we've cried a lot since this happened. I was reading a newspaper article just a little while ago about a woman in Joplin who was talking about the fact that, you know, she was crying a lot since the tornado and was trying to understand within herself, well, why am I crying? And she came to the conclusion, which really struck me, that it was true for me and many other people as well. It's gratitude. It's the gratitude for the people reaching out and embracing us in the midst of what's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
The only part of it that I will say, as bad as it was, at least no one was hurt. No person was hurt or died. And, you know, that could have happened.
What remains of the church building now?
Well, let me say first that the blessing in the whole tragedy is that the Kansas City Fire Department, you know, got on the scene. They prevented the part of the building that's a child development center, which has been around for about 30 years now, and we've helped sustain, prevented it from burning. And then with the help of the emergency disaster relief right after the fire, we were able to get it up and running in about a week. So it still remains. The only other part that remains are essentially the stone walls. And the interior of the whole rest of the building is ruined either by fire, smoke, or water.
And you can't rebuild it the way it was because codes have changed?
Codes have changed. And this is going to be, we've already hired a structural engineer to come in and begin advising us and examining the building. And really what's going to end up happening in terms of the building is going to be a question of our own vision as to who we are and what our mission is and our purpose is in Westport right now, and economic considerations. So that decision's a little bit down the road right now, but you know, we're slowly but surely walking the path to make that happen. It looks like this is going to take on into 2014 for a rebuild in whatever way it's rebuilt.
It's not unknown for churches here and everywhere to have congregational disputes, and sometimes that centers on the pastor, and sometimes pastors come and go.
Mm-hmm.
But in Westport Presbyterian's 175 years, you are only the fifth pastor?
It's pretty unusual, isn't it? It's pretty unusual to have only five pastors since 1893. It's kind of an amazing record.
But Westport has gone from being a city to a part of Kansas City, from a rather sleepy place with not much going on to a hopping entertainment district. It's changed over and over through the years. The church must have had to change with the neighborhood.
That's right. The church has changed a lot. The church is, I think, a vibrant part of the community. Our whole mission really is to be a center of community life. And we're right now in the process. We were actually doing this before the fire, a community needs assessment in Westport, because we realize Westport's very dynamic, very changing and vibrant, and we want to go out, and our goal right now is to interview 300 people, in-depth interviews on what are the needs in Westport right now. And we're on the way. We've interviewed, as of yesterday, 65 of the 300 people, and we're learning a lot in this process of thinking about rebuilding, about you know where we need to be doing our ministry in the coming years.
Westport dates back to the early 1830s when a guy named John Calvin McCoy started a store and platted it. It was here before there was a town of Kansas. John Calvin McCoy was who's on that statue at Broadway and Westport Road.
Right.
Was one of the members of the church.
That's right. That's right. There's a lot of history there. And we had one on our 175th anniversary in 2010. We had some local actors and actresses come out and play some of those historic characters during that time.
Alexander Majors, I think, was a deacon or something.
It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here with the Reverend Scott Myers of the Westport Presbyterian Church, one of the oldest, if not the oldest, congregation in these parts. Its building burned last year. If you have a question or a comment, join us by calling 816-235-2888 or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. So many years, so many changes. You became pastor in 1994.
Scott. Right.
What has changed since then?
Well, I think some of the community outreach ministries that we've done are just a hallmark of our work in the last 20 years. Arts ministry, the creation of a local arts organization called the Westport Center for the Arts, has sponsored film and discussion series, Brown Bag Concerts, Reader's Theater, bringing local artists in to display their works. We've had a very active peace ministry to children, a program we call Peace Quest. That's just a very creative peace program that occurs for children in the community. The Boy Scout troop continues to be very active, an urban scout troop that I think of as saving boys' lives one life at a time, is going to celebrate its 100th anniversary this coming year.
That's one of the oldest in town.
It is. It is. And they're really a committed group, taking kids out on campouts every month, getting them into summer camp. It's quite a group. Boy Scout Troop 60.
You have an event coming up, a fundraiser for your church.
We do. Through our arts work, two of the people that we've worked with closely and met are Walter Coppage, stage actor in Kansas City, great actor, great person, and Pam Gregory, who is a soprano. I'm a poet on the side, and we're going to do a performance called Poems That Soar, Laugh, and Sing on Sunday afternoon, June 17th at 3 o'clock, and Walter and myself, and there are a lot of singing parts in these poems, are doing this as a benefit for the fire rebuilding effort. It's a $10 donation, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
And where's it going to be?
It's going to be, you know, one of the groups that really reached out to us again, talking about gratitude after the fire, the Villa of Kansas City, which, this is a history show, used to be the Freeman Mortuary.
Uh-huh.
For quite a few years now, though, it's been a weddings and a weddings reception business, and The woman who owns that business, Raven Carr, reached out to the scout troop the night of the fire, said, you can meet down here if you like. They started meeting there, and then she reached out to us as a result, and we've ended up renting office space, Sunday school space, and they have a beautiful chapel. Music is a big part of our church. It's a beautiful chapel for acoustics. And that's where we are, and that's where the poetry performance is going to be.
And it's an attractive building of some longstanding right near the Vietnam Monument.
That's right. That's right. And it's, you know, it's two blocks from our old building. So it's a great deal for us and for them.
And that's where your event will be. You mentioned that you're a poet, and
yeah.
you can you share a little bit of that poem with us?
Sure. Sure, I'd like to share a poem that really is just recently written, and it's a tribute, really, to an African-American artist by the name of Stan Morgan, who is an active member of our congregation and has been for some time. And I'd like to share this poem that's a tribute to Stan. Summer's hitting town in a big hurry this year, and the local art museum's Friday night all-nighter for family and kids is a cheap solution to my unair-conditioned box fan-cooled apartment. Mm-hmm. So around 9:30 p.m., and the sun still hadn't run out of sight yet, I found myself hanging out in one of the third-floor galleries, taking in an Archibald Motley painting I can never get enough of. A dimly lit, jumping, jazzy nightclub scene all filled up in the foreground with this gorgeous-looking girl wearing a red satin dress that's tighter than Dick's hat band. Bright, shiny, smooching red lipstick and some sure-enough special fine dancing legs that were most definitely taking the A-train with the Duke, Ellington, that is, and her handsome dancing boyfriend just cruising along for the ride, which, don't get me wrong, from the look on that boy's face, he didn't mind at all being taken along for the ride. I'm telling the truth about you. Don't you go getting happy with my licorice stick. Then before you could say Sugar Ray, this bald-headed, skinny black man with a thin little pencil mustache and an earring dangling from his left ear came shuffling and sliding like a shadow across the gallery floor, wearing one of those masks. Remember, like the Lone Ranger used to wear on Saturday morning television? And when he rode away on his white horse after giving the bad guys another good solid whooping that they surely did deserve, the folks who had seen it all go down would shout out, "Who was that masked man? Who was that masked man?" Well, I'm telling the truth. That is just what they ended up wondering late last Friday evening, right there in the third floor gallery of the city's finer than fine arts museum. Every soul old Archibald Motley could think of putting into his painting was gawking at the gorgeous looking girl and her handsome dancing boyfriend. Both of them snuggling up to taking the A-train with the Duke, when all at once, in one slow, synchronistic motion, they all turned their heads to get a good, long, curious look at the bald, skinny, masked black guy as he went shuffling and sliding his way past the gallery guard, slipped through the doorway, out into the hallway, and then disappeared around the corner. So all you could make out was his shadow stretching out along the wall toward the third-floor elevator doors. "Was that man Archibald Motley himself?" I heard a young boy ask his father. "No, son, that'd be impossible," his father replied. "Archibald Motley passed long before you were born." "Well, then who was that masked man, Daddy?" the boy replied. I wanted to go over and tell him right then and there, but for some reason I couldn't chase down the words in my heart to say them, so I'll just tell you. "Come on over here next to me. I'll whisper it in your ear." "That was Stan the man, little boy. Stan the fine arts-making man. Stan the mask-making man. The inner-city swimming pool mural-making man. Stan the found some fine art right on your own city block, right on your own front porch, man. Why, all you need to do to get yourself a mask that's made by Stan the Man is go hunting around your neighborhood tomorrow, first thing in the morning. Start off with some genuine Missouri bur oak tree planks from your auntie's broken back porch steps, nailed together double thick and jigsawed into a sturdy oval shape. Maybe you find a couple of pool hall cue balls for some big eyes, preferably not too scuffed up, a lost necklace for a mouth, but not too big, and a wig, a couple of cat's eyes marbles, a pair of dice would be very nice, one Vienna sausage tin for the chin, two big old washers for ears, a wallet-sized color prayer card of the heart of Jesus with a picture of Barack Obama stuck to its backside, and a piece of a broken Donna Summer's Disco Dancing in the Sky long-playing record that'll make your mask want to jump up and sing. Little boy, you are the luckiest little boy in the whole land, because Stan the Man is going to make you some of the finest found art in all of God's great big happy plan. Oh, I hope to shout, when the truth about you comes out. We get to know people a lot better, not by looking directly at them, but by looking at what they themselves are looking at. That's what I have learned in my time of knowing Stan the Man.
Pastor and poet, the Reverend Scott Myers of Westport Presbyterian Church. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with your fundraising event two Sundays from now.
Hey, thanks a lot.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guest has been Scott Myers of Westport Pres. And earlier we heard from Ladine Morton, author of The Waldo Story, about that neighborhood in South Kansas City. For more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Central Standard Friday was produced today by Charlie Upchurch. I'm Munro Dodd. Tune into Central Standard Friday next week for the Food Critics, and enjoy your day.